Thank you very much for coming, and it's a pleasure. I want to thank Jay, Elliot, the Calvins, Alana, and everybody who's made this happen. And I want you to know this is my second time here, and it's really as I grow, I'm more into Eichut than Kamut. There's a nice Kamut here. In other words, quality. I think that to realize. Sometimes we become very capitalistic. I think we always should judge the success of an organization or a school or a movement based on numbers. Now, you need a critical mass in order for things to sustain themselves economically, et cetera. But when you look at the quality, look at the engagement, I experienced that in Or HaChaim over Shabbat. I'm experiencing that since last night here. And then the sustainability, 15 years, what a core of people who are dedicated to study and openness. And to have the privilege of engaging you is something that I don't take for granted. So very, very happy to be here. For this talk, I'm going to be presenting something that I worked on and that appears in this book here, Beyond Sectarianism. And there's actually also a chapter here that relates to the Lichtstein family and KJ. So if people are interested in those topics, it's available on Amazon. I'm not really trying to advertise because academic books are not profitable. But once you do write them, and it did get the National Jewish Book Award, it's nice when people read them because you feel like, wow, what an opportunity to disseminate knowledge. So if there are people who find these topics interesting, the book is available, and it would be great if people read it. My mother likes it. So a lot of people have written, for very good reasons, and thought a lot about women in Orthodoxy. But almost all the writing, not all, but almost all the writing and all the discussion has focused on the modern Orthodox group, however we define that. And for very good reason. And I'm talking about within Orthodoxy. Of course, a lot has been written about female rabbis within the Reform movement, Conservative movement, the history, etc. Some people say that it's just a matter of a delay of 20 years between movement to movement, and it's sort of deterministic. Well, maybe we'll get back to that towards the end. But much less has been written about the more Haredi sectors of Orthodoxy. And there's been a general assumption, sometimes with great substance or it really could be backed up, that the Haredi world, number one, is anti-feminist, that the Haredi world does everything it can to maintain the status quo of whenever that began. I don't know if there was ever a status quo, whatever that we call, it's a very good book by Benedict Anderson, it's called Imagined Communities. It's about nationalism, that the idea that there's a Hungarian nation, there's a French nation, is something that was sort of imagined by leaders at a certain point when when feudalism declined and people wanted to get, and religion no longer united people. So there's sort of this imagined status quo of Judaism from Eastern Europe, maybe, if it ever existed. But whatever it is, there's an assumption that the Haredi world is still very much ensconced in that perception of many, many, many areas, certainly in the area of gender, women, etc. Now, what I'd like to present here are one point that was made by others, and then focus on a second one, which I think is less known, although some of you may know this as well, and hopefully there'll be enough time for me to learn from you as well, because I'm sure there are people here who live in the spectrums of Jewish life and have their own experiences. And I'll just add one more point that may be a little bit nuanced, but it's important. I'm a historian. Once upon a time, historians were looked at as the authorities of truth, okay? No, I think that there are facts in this world, and there are facts that have to be understood, and there are things that are not facts. Having said that, It's clear to me, and it's clear to most everybody in my profession, that what historians are interpreters of culture, interpreters of facts. Now, what professional academics, historians, people in the social sciences or in the humanities do is they don't just say things. They back them up with footnotes. They bring sources. They provide close readings. Having said that, I want to make it clear that this is my interpretive narrative of the facts that I have observed, read, seen, and I think it's compelling. It doesn't mean it's the only one. I think that it offers certain insight into trends that are developing. But again, I want, if we have a discussion, it would be to add or to offer an alternative narrative, but it's not a discussion of, oh, that's wrong, that's right. It's a discussion of how we can grow and learn together through our interpretation or our understanding, or bring additional facts that maybe I'm not aware of that will add to it. So the first point I want to make is that it should be absolutely clear that the role of women in traditionalist Orthodox Jewish life is so different from what it was 130 years ago, that it's unimaginable. And here, when I gave the title Beyond Beis Yaakov, and that's because the first revolution is clearly Beis Yaakov. Today, Beis Yaakov is perceived as a conservative with a small c institution that is seen as training young women to be dedicated to a Torah life in Israel, very much to supporting their husbands as full-time learners. There's a whole ideology that Rav Wolf from Beis Yaakov in Israel developed in terms of Chevrat Lomdim, a learning society, and the role of women in sustaining that. That in itself is a new phenomenon, the Chevrat Lomdim. But when you look at Beis Yaakov, that started in the second half of the second decade of the 20th century in Poland, and Sara Schneer, and the involvement of the Chafetz Chaim, and of the Belzer Rebbe, we're not going to go into all that history now. First of all, it was clear it was a revolution. Sara Schneer, if you read her letters, she says, you know, in the Hasidic families in Krakow, I see that on Chagim, all the men go to their rebbes, the women are alone. The girls who are already going to mandatory high schools and going on to universities, they're receiving minimal Jewish education. They don't feel a place in the synagogue. They don't feel that religion is central to them. They feel that there's this disparity between the level of knowledge and their abilities, their intellectual abilities that are maybe being mandatory, but in the end of the day, they're learning the stuff in the school and what they received outside the home in any sort of formal Jewish education. And she advanced a program which was meant to offer more challenging, high-level study of Jewish texts, not just Chumash. There was discussion, if you look at the Chafetz Chaim's letters, where he says that, yes, today the rabbinic dictum that kol ha-melamed ishto Torah kilu melamda tiflut, that women who learn Torah are like learning something lustful or learning something they're not capable intellectually, however you interpret the word tiflut, that does not apply, and that women can learn certain types of Torah Shabbal Peh, certain types of oral law, certain types of different texts, whether it's Gemara or not. In other words, I see from my macro perspective all these debates about Gemara, not Gemara, Iyun, not Iyun. You know, it's a little suspect to me that, let's say, somebody who I know personally, I like very much, Rabbi Willig, who gave the first shiur in Stern College when the Rav said you could give Talmud classes to women in Stern College. He was the Magid Shir for her first half year. I spoke to him about it. Now he says, I don't know if it was such a good idea and maybe women shouldn't learn Gemara anymore. And there's a picture. You can see the picture of Rabbi Soloveitchik giving the shiur and Rabbi Willig sitting on the side, the opening shiur. So, you know, things happen. But to me, the bigger issue is not whether it's Talmud or not Talmud. It's that this Beis Yaakov opened it up. And even more than the fact that female students start to come in, if you look at the history, I mean, During the interwar period, by the late 1930s, there were like 230,000 young ladies in Poland, parts of Russia, of Lithuania, even in Hungary, spreading further, who were studying in Beis Yaakov schools. Now that's huge, and the Agudas Yisrael supported it, which was very important there. But even more important, and this is very relevant to today. Very soon after the school was started, and I think it was 1917, 1918, Sarah Schneer realized that she needed to train female teachers. That if this was going to work, they had to have a training seminary to develop a cadre of highly educated women who could teach the subjects. That it shouldn't be men teaching the subject, or not exclusively men, it should be women. And that these women, the girls needed female role models in order not to deviate from religion, but on the contrary, in order to inspire them, in order to give them the sense that religion was compelling, that it was intellectually challenging, that it was spiritually uplifting, etc., etc. Now, what were those messages? Again, to me, those are important details, but they're details. That idea, if you think about it, all these debates today about Rabbah, Maharat, women rabbis, all these things, you know, those are things that, you know, like in anything, it's fair for people to debate where you decide to set your boundaries, et cetera. And that's an interesting and important existential, halachic, public debate about, you know, incremental change or whether there are things that you'd never change, et cetera. But, I mean, face it, Beis Yaakov was training female religious leaders and has been since then in both the non-Hasidic Misnagdic Lithuanian community, and then in the Hasidic communities as well. Okay, so I think it's very important from a historical perspective. I'm sure some of you are aware of this, but to set that straight. Then the question here, you know, if I called my talk Beyond Beis Yaakov, then the question would be, well, has anything changed within the Haredi community, or is the Beis Yaakov model still the only paradigm? And what I argued in my book and what I want to present to you here is that I feel, I don't just feel, that I have seen through reading, through witnessing, through traveling, through interviews, through a broad array of tools that I try to use in order to understand contemporary Jewry and contemporary Judaism, that there is something new, different going on that, to my mind, is not exactly the same as what's going on in the modern Orthodox community in terms of female leadership, but nonetheless is what I call a silent revolution. And I'll say this now, and maybe I'll repeat it at the end. To be clear, if the majority of Orthodox Jews in the world, certainly in North America and in Israel, identify with the Haredi world, and if we like to think about how that critical mass is developing, I think that it is in certain ways no less and maybe more important to understand how the role of women and female leadership is evolving in the majority Haredi world than, you know, just as important as all the studies that have focused in on the modern Orthodox trailblazing things that I respect very much and that I appreciate from, you know, our good friend Blue Greenberg moving forward, and the Midrashot in Israel and all those, and, you know, Migdal Oz, et cetera, et cetera. So this is what I have found. Rabbi Lookstein heard this lecture already, so he's putter. I gave it at KJ on Friday night when I was the scholar in residence there. So I just wanted to make sure you weren't Choshed B'Ksherim, you know.
I told you Nachama Leibovitz always said, Hey, lo zochrim
Well, then we'll have to test him afterwards, right? So this is what I've found. A lot of the area where I see the pioneering and changing roles for women in the Haredi world comes from the sector of kiruv, of outreach. Outreach is a very, very central force within Haredi life. It is not the majority, certainly among Hasidim, most Hasidim who live in Williamsburg, or who live in New Square, or who live in Israel, in the Kiryat Gur in Chatzor Glilit, or in Muncie, etc. They're not directly involved in outreach. Outreach is the elite. Outreach is, in certain ways, avant-garde. Nonetheless, outreach is one of the key ways through which, and I want this to be, this is an important nuance. Not only the Haredi world influences Jews who are unaffiliated or Jews who are not Haredi, but I would say, I couldn't measure it exactly, but one could argue that the stronger influence is the rebound. In other words, because people who come from the Haredi world have become so involved in outreach, they're different, and that comes back and affects the Haredi world. So I think it's important to understand that it's not just the elite, those young couples who go to community kolels or who do Eish HaTorah programs or who do all sorts of things who are being affected, but it's their families, relatives who visit, who are exposed. It's the training programs that exist through Ner Le'elef in Israel. It's training programs in Olney, Maryland for the Baltimore people. It's all sorts of things where you see Haredi families, if you have, let's say, I don't know what the average is today, if you have 8 children and one or two of them, one of the sons wasn't going to be a Rosh Shiva or a Melamed and didn't have a father-in-law to go into business with or didn't want to learn computers or something in an online university like it's very popular today, but saw this as a vocation. It's a cottage industry, wanted to help be involved in Yiddishkeit and took that direction. And one of his sisters married his chavrusa or from Lakewood or from Baltimore or from Tells or from other or who was connected to the Chicago Kollel or the Toronto Kollel. Toronto Kollel is not quite as kiruv as Chicago, for example. But I'm sure there are people here who are familiar with some of the work of the Toronto Kollel. Then you have 8 children, but 2 of them are doing this. People come for Shabbos, people have smachot, people end up going to places like Palo Alto and going to places like Houston, Texas, and to Atlanta, Georgia, and to Dallas, et cetera, Columbus, Ohio, et cetera, and therefore the enclave may remain in Williamsburg, in Crown Heights, in Muncie, et cetera. Nonetheless, in an age of globalization, of travel, of media, of Facebook exposure, websites, etc., the WhatsApp, it doesn't, the locale does not, is not the only definition of a person's exposure and development of identity. So one of the things, and you know, everyone knows that, well, I don't know if everyone, I don't know if everyone knows that the people, the pioneers of Kiruv, were Modern Orthodox people, that the Department of Communal Services of Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan was doing a lot of kiruv in the 1950s and in the 60s, and that when the Lubavitcher Rebbe decided he wanted to set up with Rav Kunin the first Chabad house in UCLA in 1968, he invited Rivka Was she still tights? I think so. She hadn't married Rabbi Blau then, the Mashgiach of YU, Rivka Tights, and I forget who the other person was, who were the presidents of the Yavne organization, which was a university student Orthodox organization. And he invited them for a session to talk to them about what are university students interested in? Are they interested in conflicts of science and Torah? Are they interested in biblical criticism? Are they interested in Eastern spirituality? Will they relate to Hasidus? So it should be known that once upon a time, and I would argue at a time where people who self-identify as modern Orthodox were confident that this was, whether the Rambam would daven in their shul or not, that this was a viable and not just a compromise, but it was a viable and meaningful and had a truth to it, a way of avodat Hashem, and not just something that works or something that is second best. Then, when you're self-confident in your own way, generally, that will lead to more willingness to go out. It was also a time where I think that there was less of a sense that the only way a person, I mentioned this last night, that a person could lead a modern Orthodox life was to earn, it depends where you live, if it's in the five towns in New York, $500,000. If it's Toronto, it might be a little bit less. If it's in other neighborhoods, I don't know what the number is. But whatever the number is, to earn ridiculously large amounts of money, which can only be attained through not only two incomes, but through usually through certain professions, unless a person is willing to live a little different than most of their neighbors. So those two factors sort of are among those that led to, you know, a sense of defensiveness and a need to like sort of become more enclavist than the Haredim in a certain way in order to protect the children, right? And the sense that, how can my child be a rabbi? You know, I don't want this to be a critical talk, but it's really noticeable because I study these things, how like Yeshiva University developed the Center for Jewish Leadership. It's a wonderful thing. Wonderful thing. And they encouraged. Someone told me Coke Zero is very Israeli, that Americans drink Diet Coke. So it's nice to see Rabbi Lichtstein is making aliyah.
Coke Zero tastes like what regular Coke tasted like when I was a kid. You would not appreciate that.
My mom would, so I'll think. Don't drink Pepsi, the Soviet, the... in any case, for even the young, wonderful rabbis that are being trained, certainly in Yeshiva University and in some of the Israeli institutions, who go out to places beyond those key centers, it's seen as a career path. It's seen as, just like somebody might work in big industry for a few years to get the exposure before they make their startup or before they do their thing or before they go back to a place where they're in their comfort zone. Whereas what I see among certainly Chabad, but among Haredim in the Lithuanian sector as well, is that Kiruv and living outside the core is a life decision. And it's a commitment. Yes, some people do move, but when people go to these places, it's with the idea that if it works, I am staying, and it's not as a jump, if I give 3-5 years in Cleveland or in Toronto, well, then when the Fifth Avenue Synagogue comes up, then I can put in my, it's a different trajectory, and it has very strong implications for how local communities see their leaders and how they see their commitment to the growth of the community. Now let's go back to what, so a lot of what I've seen is in the world of outreach of Kiruv. And here I do want to touch on Chabad, because Chabad is within the, beyond what I said about the Department of Youth Services of Yeshiva University. Chabad certainly were pioneers. Already the sixth Rebbe, Rabbi Isaac Schneerson, who among others sent Shlomo Kalibach and Zalman Shachter Shlomi out to the college campuses already in the 1950s. They were the first shluchim. Eventually they deviated from Chabad, but they were essentially Chabadnikim. They remained Chabadnikim in many ways. But Chabad and the seventh Rebbe certainly, alav hashalom, realized that if you want to bring American or contemporary Jews wherever to Judaism, then one of the keys was women. Women. And if you look at his writings, and if you look at his, the whole concept of shlichus is a shaliach and a shlucha. And anyone who has spent time in Chabad houses anywhere in the world, and I go to a lot of them, in Beijing, or in Thailand, or in different parts of North America, or in South, wherever you go, it's the couple. There's divisions of labor. You know, if anyone's ever been to the Chabad house in Beijing, Dini, I forgot her last name now, she set up a Chabad Montessori school in Beijing because she realized, you've been there? Because she realized that's a way. She also makes challahs. But that school brings people, and she made sure to get training and to hire teachers that are really high level. And they figured out that's a way to attract people to what they do. And there is a good example. It's absolutely clear that there's a partnership. The theology and the ideology, there people have written a little bit about this, about a certain type of sort of, anti-feminist feminism, where it's absolutely clear from if Rabbi Lichtenstein used the term, I'm a practical pluralist, but not a theological pluralist. So there's something of that in Chabad, where there's sort of a, of course my role is to be the Ezer Kenegdo, of course my husband is the leader, et cetera, in practice. And in also some of the Chabad writings, you see very clearly that there is a sense that women are leaders, women are touch people's souls, and if the goal is to gather sparks, if the goal is every mitzvah is a raising of another spark from a Lurianic Kabbalistic perspective, if the goal is if enough sparks will rise, then the redemption will be achieved, and that is the basic way that Chabad looks at the world. And that's why Chabad can even say academic study is important, can even say that all sorts of telethons and things are important, not for the money. If John Voight says that Chabad is good, maybe that's going to raise some sparks. So it may not be because a contemporary sense of egalitarianism, a contemporary sense of this whole idea of distinguishing between male and female, and some people might find that offensive and say that in a world in which there's so much effort, at least certainly in the United States, to erase sort of gender distinctions, well, this is so arcane, and it bothered, and I'm not belittling that, but it is what it is, and on a pragmatic level, the role of women in Chabad in many ways has been much more prominent as religious leaders way before the Midrashot in Israel started to train modern Orthodox women in learning Talmud, and way before Maharats and Yoatzot Halacha and Rabot and all these things took place. It was a different path. What I found particularly interesting as part of a broader picture that I've seen, and that's what a lot of this book is about, is how the role of women is one more area in which through outreach, not only Chabad, but the Lithuanian non-Hasidic world has started to change. And my recognition of this, I guess, began when I started doing a project on community kollels, community outreach kollels in America, and I started to travel. Even before I traveled, I remember the first, remember that last year there was a big scandal because they, or no, it was maybe 3 years ago, when they assassinated Obama, and there was a picture of the, Obama, Chas v'Chalila, I can't believe it. That's not Freudian, I promise you. When they assassinated Bin Laden, and I could you please erase that? Please erase that. I'm so embarrassed. Okay, when Obama and his cabinet, his war cabinet, was in the basement of the White House, and they were watching live as they assassinated Bin Laden. Bin Laden, okay? Okay? And Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State, and she was there. And in Hamodia or in Yated Ne'eman, what do they call that? Yeah. Photoshopped Hillary Clinton out, because how can you have a picture of a woman? You know, that was, okay. Now, I'm looking at that. Mishpacha now had her? See, there you go. Mishpacha just proved my thesis. We don't need it anywhere. Let's go home. But I was laughing because I've gone through all the websites of the community Kollels. And if you go on to the website of the Ask Kollel, Atlanta Scholars Kollel, or the Palo Alto JSN, Jewish Study Network, or the Torch Kollel in Houston, et cetera, they all have a separate web page with the woman, just like the Chabad Shluchos, with pictures, dressed nicely, attractive. And it's very, very clear that just on a visual level, there's a recognition. If you want people to come in, and you, first of all, you have women doing kiruv work, and you put their pictures up. So, we're all, foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of young vines. Of course, people are inconsistent, but it is kind of interesting that you could, whitewash when it comes to Hillary Clinton, and at the same time, you have these Rebbetzins, right? You know, these Beis Yaakov girls who are front and center on the web that goes viral. Now, if it's just a picture, okay, that's visual, and it has a meaning. But then I went to visit these places, and I started to see that it's real partnership. That similar to Chabad, but different, that women are involved in not just in making Shabbos meals and the traditional things, but in planning programming, in organizing programming, that people work, men and I didn't really define it, but I'm assuming people know it. Community outreach kollels, the way it works is the guys have a Seder in the morning. They might have a second Seder. Other than that, they do kiruv work. They do lunch and learns. They do history of Israel, a history of Judaism courses. They do ulpans. They do speed dating programs. They do all sorts of work with the community in different levels, teaching chevrutas. And I found out that a kollel guy and a wife of another kollel guy can work together on a program. I found out that sometimes they have separate gender, guy-based medrash, female-based medrash, but not always, because someone will come. And in other words, Chabad, if you take the parallel Chabad for the gula, you could change things. And one of the things I'm writing about now, actually, is about how kiruv affects halacha and all the different leniencies and changes in halacha that I found when I started reading halacha books that have been written for the kiruv movement. And there's a whole literature of kiruv halacha books and all sorts of things that, so what you find is like a two-tier halacha. There's the halacha for Muncie and there's the halacha for Columbus. Same people, same families, same relatives. Again, think about that. I remember when I was in Dallas and I went to this. Has anyone ever been to the Dallas where there's the modern Orthodox shul and there's the sort of yeshivish shul which started from the kollel? So they have downstairs a very, very high mechitza, like you would find in a more yeshivish shul. I went upstairs with Rabbi Epstein, Bensi Epstein, who's the sort of the CEO of the kollel, and he says, this is where, it was like a room maybe a little about this size. A little smaller. He says, this is where we do our introductory service. I said, that's great. So I see, like, this little thing. Rav Soloveitchik's head, or Rav Moshe, right? Yeah. I said, what's that? Oh, it's the mechitza. He said, we only put that there for Shemona Esrei, for Shemona Esrei, because it's really only Ikar Tefillah, you only need a mechitza, It is a bit Knesset Kavuah, okay. I said, yeah? He says, because they need to sit together. I mean, if we separate them too much, they're not going to come. We want them to learn about Yiddishkeit. And I'm like, wow, you know, you remember the Mechitza controversies of the 1950s? And remember the whole questions? And, you know, and I wouldn't step foot in the Jewish center on is it 86th Street? Because the Jewish center in Manhattan has that La Mechitza, or in the Hebrew Institute of Riverdale, because, you know, it's the Mechitza's in the middle. And here I'm going into this Haredi shul. So is it for Geula, for Kiruv? But it's really interesting. You have to see these things with your own eyes. So I saw women also teach in front of mixed audiences. Women, I wouldn't say you'll find a chavruta between a kolal wife, let's say, and a member of the community or something like that. But, you know, certainly around the Shabbos table, people interface. I remember one of the very interesting experiences I had. I was interviewing a Rosh Kol. I was actually in Jerusalem, very fine young man, was doing great work. And he was telling me that his kolel, it's yeshivish, but they try to be a little open. They realize it would be really helpful to have a few YU guys. Like from the more, I guess they call it the Rav Shachter group, like the more yeshivish YU guys. So, like Jay, you're right, yeah. So, yeah. He said that they had a problem because they had these great YU guys who came and they thought they'd really be very helpful, and but then they were talking and the YU guy had a question. He said, well, so on those few Shabbases, the Shabbatot, when we don't invite our constituency to share the Shabbos and the beauty of the Shabbos together. So do couples, like, you know, get together for meals and stuff like that? And they said, of course not. Of course not. We don't socialize that way. Couples can't sit at the same table together. It's not appropriate. So there's this duality that I find fascinating. But so I'm not saying it's all one way or the other, but it's a complexity that you don't see from reading Yated Ne'eman or from hearing certain types of Musar discussions or from witnessing a rally against the internet or against cell phones or stuff like that. There's something much more liminal that goes on, and one of the factors that is crucial in this is Kirov, because there's a recognition if you have a constituency, if you have a group that you're targeting, you have to speak their language intellectually, culturally. You have to have Super Bowl parties, and you have to have kollel golf tournaments, and you have to have cool people who know how to speak the genre and can drink a little beer too. But you also have to have men and women who are in their comfort zone with a broad range of people. And so what's happened is that women have grown within the Haredi Kiruv world, not only but mostly, that are starting to be, I'm not going to call them rabbis because they're not called rabbis, but they're like rabbis. One of them actually spent some time here in Toronto. I don't think she's here anymore. But anyone know Lori Palatnik? Lori Palatnik is a superstar. She is unbelievably charismatic. She speaks in front of huge mixed audiences all over the world. She does something that I've seen not only in Jewish Kiruv, but in any sort of like mega church. I was once in Houston, and it's a crazy story. I gave a talk in Houston at the JCC. I was the scholar in residence there for a month. And I mentioned something about Lakewood and changes in Lakewood and something like that. And this woman comes over to me afterwards. And Houston is not, you know, it has an Orthodox contingent, but the JCC is more of the old guard reform. And she says to me, you know, that was so interesting about Lakewood. It's so different than what I know about Lakewood, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm listening for a few minutes, and it doesn't make sense and everything. Someone comes over to me, she's talking about the Lakewood Church. The Lakewood Church is the largest, like, I forget the name of the guy. It's televised to 100, you know, a million people all over the world watch their service. It was so big, they bought the old Houston Rockets arena for their Sunday services. So this philanthropist there said, why don't you come see it? So I'm comfortable from a halachic perspective with that. I went, and half the people there, unfortunately, are Jews. And I went to Sunday morning, Lakewood not Cutler, but Lakewood Church service. And it was the regular minion. It was the regular minion, and it was much, you know, they're much smarter, you know, because we don't use money on chops. They sold lots of books outside and the refreshments, everything before the services. Actually, I saw that once in Australia. They wanted people to come to Mincha Minyan at an Orthodox shul. Friday night, I come into shul, and everyone's eating herring. And I said, what's going on? I was a little late. They said, oh, no one was getting there in time for Mincha, so we said if they'll make a kiddush after Mincha, people are going to come to Friday night, you know. So if you go to the... I forget what the shul is. Okay, in Caulfield in Melbourne. Okay, so at Lakewood Church, it's all about self-help. All about self-help. I heard Jesus said maybe twice. They have like a pull-down screen with the cross at one point for about 5 minutes. The rest of it is you having trouble in your marriage. Is your work getting you down? Are your kids deviating? Are there drug issues? Real issues, but it's the self-help and then a little bit of religion and spirituality with a big 40-piece band and dancers and stuff like that. So now, if you watch, and it's really easy to watch Lori Palatnik because she's on, Aish has her... her sessions every week, and she's on the web all over the place. You just do Lori Palatnik in YouTube, you will see lots of speeches in South Africa, all over the United States, and Israel. And her discourse is discourse of self-help, and it's very contemporary. She has great stories, but she also talks about Judaism and about Ahavat Hashem and about mitzvos. And she certainly identifies with the Haredi world. Her husband and her kids go to yeshivas in the Haredi world. Her husband is connected to it. But on the other hand, she was given this award by Hadassah Women on their Scroll of Honor, together with Bella Abzug and with Ruth Ginsburg and with Gloria Steinem. She's on the list. You could see it. Now, maybe they didn't understand, but that's really fascinating that a Haredi woman Kiruv specialist is now perceived in the pantheon of great women leaders of the 21st century. So not everyone's a Lori Palatnik, but there are more of them. There are more of them. Some would say that Rebbetzin Youngreis, who passed away this year, who used to give a regular session on the premises of KJ, was the pioneer. I'm not sure she was really Haredi. She said maybe her kids are. Her husband's shul was not a Haredi shul. She was Hungarian. She was a little different. But certainly that was... I can say these things as opposed to Rabbi Lichtenstein because my wife's family is from Debrecen. And, you know... Grunblatt, you know, and Kitschy Kitschy, and we know what the real mama, the real Lashon HaKodesh is. So, you know, okay, so I got cred here. In any case, this I think is a phenomenon that I witnessed in many, many places, and I think it's a parallel track. I never like to say everything's, I hate when people say that history repeats itself, because it never repeats itself. There are tomes, themes, there are different aspects that we can see correlations and we can gain insight through looking at the past to the present and future. But to say it's just the same, I think that's shallow and that's not an accurate reading of things. So I don't think that Haredi female leaders are the same as modern Orthodox leaders. I think there are certain commonalities. And if we had time, I would also talk about how the Haredi leadership is reacting to this. Maybe I'll just say telegraphically. My sense is that the fact that the Haredi leadership has gone out of its way to condemn things going on in the modern Orthodox world, when theoretically it should be of no interest to them because it's not their constituency, is because it's a way to set boundaries within their own world. By saying that women rabbis is terrible and these people are not Orthodox, by Rabbi, what's his name, the head of the of Moetzes Gedolei, Rav Perlo, coming out so emphatically against any sort of official titles for women, etc. To my mind, that is really talking to his own group and making clear that, yes, I know. I mean, Rav Kamenetsky from Philadelphia encourages a lot of this cure of work and encourages a lot of these people. And he's on the Moetzes, and he's the same one who signed on all those diatribes against Avi Weiss and against Chovei Torah and against all these things. So I really do think that to look at it as a purely an attack on the modern Orthodox is simplistic, and that it's much of it is because they recognize that there's a lot of change in their own realm, and therefore it's a way sort of to push back without attacking Kiruv, because Kiruv is something that they want to encourage for many reasons that we talk about. I'll make one last comment, because I'd like to leave a little time. I think we have about 7 minutes for some discussion or questions or comments or critiques, which is that I think that I sort of alluded to this in another subject yesterday, but it's getting harder and harder, and I'm looking as a historian, but I think we see it, to look at what was once called the gender revolution or feminism as a passing trend. I mean, this is deterministically a huge change in the whole sort of paradigm of Western life that we, many of us here, have lived through. I mean, Rabbi Lichtenstein, you've lived through it, and you've talked about how you've changed through it and how you've also sort of tried to set certain boundaries on it. And I'm younger, but I see it. I see that it depends geographically, and I think in my next talk I'm going to look at a little bit about how things have evolved, developed in Israel, in America, in North America, and interactions, et cetera. But I think that the fact that the sector of Orthodoxy, which is perceived as the most conservative, as the most antagonistic to change, as in foundationally opposed to certain types of deviations from classical models, is also in its own way sort of by osmosis or through less in your face or less formalistic ways absorbing, adapting, even encouraging these new types of roles for females as religious leaders. I think that that tells you something beyond the specifics of feminism and of roles of women. It tells you something about, it sort of, to me, feels like we live in an age secularism really became strong in the end of the 18th century, in the beginning of the 19th century. We live at a very dynamic, liminal period. I am not an Avi, and I don't know where it's going. But I think it helps us. I think it helps us a lot to recognize that. And from my perspective, the female gender, also sexual identity, but we didn't touch on that here, these issues are very strong and are moving. And if we talk about Torah in motion, I think that's a huge responsibility. It's a huge challenge. How does Torah stay in motion in such a vortex, in such a time of so much movement and dynamism? And not and when I say Torah in motion, and one of the reasons, sometimes at first I didn't like the title of the organization. I thought it was a little kitschy. But what I like about it, yeah, well, exactly, the Torah in motion doesn't mean Torah in defense. It means that we believe wholeheartedly that the Torah was given by God as Torat Chaim midor ledor for every generation. And in as much as one could look at all these things, oh my God, I don't think that that's the perspective that you try to project here. And I don't think it's the one that is healthy for us. But we should be aware of these things. and see how actually we can use them as stepping stones to lahagdil Torah ulahadira. Thank you. No, no, no. Do people have any comments? Yeah, I stopped purposely to, you know. Okay, please.
I have a question regarding the role of Haredi women as breadwinners, or the increasing role as breadwinners, and how is that affecting the trends that you were discussing?
So, I think it's a wonderful. Wonder he's taking the Coke Zero with him. I was hoping to get some after. No, Rabbi Lichtstein, you know.
Absolutely.
I was always a troublemaker in Ramas. No,
take it.
So now I need a cup. I haven't thought. I think it's a wonderful question. I think that it clearly is an intuition that you have. Once women, that's how it started, or that's certainly a big part of it. If you're involved professionally and you're developed professionally and you're educated professionally, then you develop tools. Now, number one, human resources. If there are people who are good at, whether it be teaching or graphic art or just practically, what are you going to do? You're not going to use the resources that you have. People are trained in medical sciences or in law. I mean, I don't know. I mean, if there was some time, and my wife's a neuroscientist, if someone came to the conclusion that neuroscience would be helpful for Yiddishkeit, I would hope they would turn to her and say, hey, how can we pick your brain or utilize you? I mean, so I think that there's a direct correlation. But I think more than that, when you step out of the home and when you become independent, it changes things. In Israel, and maybe I'll touch on it in the next session, in Israel, it's important to recognize that Israel's changing a lot. I don't think it's a reaction to the fact that women are breadwinners, but I think that there is a realization that that's not sufficient, that one generation was able to sustain itself with men learning kol for many, many years and then going into chinuch or et cetera, and women being breadwinners. Number one, women have left chinuch and certain professions and are going into many, many more. Oh no, now I am so embarrassed. Chatati, aviti, vashati.
Mikol melamda yiskal.
Ay, vey, 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 vey. No, you're not allowed. That's rash machar kvado, ein kvado machar. Do I have to lean to the left or something? No, I'm good. No. Yeah. It's good. Coke Sierra. So,
Rabbi Lichtstein,
Rabbi Lichtstein.
Rabbi Lichtstein.
I think that there is a relationship between women going into other professions and women going into religious leadership in the Haredi world, no less than in the broader society. Yes.
I was just going to respond to that in the sense that many Muslims who are reform are saying that what's wrong with Muslim is the fact that they're leaving half of their population out of growth, which is women. And I think that's what Orthodoxy has done. They've included women. For example, 1945 here in Canada.
We can give a chance to other people. You had a question.
Just the whole business of the whole representation of women's participation is b'diavad and not lechatchila. If it's necessary, if we have to do it, but it's really unfortunate that we're in this position. And I think, first of all, there's the obvious analogy to their view about participation in the world of culture in general. But also, do you have anything to say about how this affects relationships between husbands and wives, where women have a sense of doing worthwhile work and yet it's constantly undercut?
It's a wonderful, wonderful question. I'll just say, before we get to that second piece, is that when I observe something, I try to observe it I can't leave my values outside. But I try to observe it and say, just because it's not the same, it's something. So when you ask and say, well, yeah, but they think it's b'di'avad, yeah, could be. But in practice, you know, that's the way the world works. Things start as pragmatic, and eventually they become foundational. So I don't think the fact that that's the source. Okay, regarding how it affects relationships, I don't know a lot about it. I think it's a very important subject. I imagine that there might be some differences, but there's a lot of literature on how institutions and what was once called the sort of the nuclear family has changed, in part due to female empowerment and female participation in economics of and in professional life. And sometimes it's pejorative. Often, I think it's just, you know, good scholarship. And my friend Sylvia Barak Fishman wrote a great article, I don't know if you read it a couple of years ago, about, and again, I'm not making a statement. It was very annoying. My mother, who's very modern Orthodox, open, but she's very traditionalist about roles of men and women. And she goes, Adam, you know, I love Blue. She's my friend, but what's she doing? You know, if men stop, you know, women are from, you know, men have to go to shul. If they don't go to shul, then they, and if they're not, they need that, you know, like very, you know, old talk. And I would say to her, Mom, I don't know, you know, it doesn't, you know, it just seems like a box that you're, anyway, Sylvia made this study of in non-Orthodox synagogues where women become president, and very, very quickly, the men stopped coming to shul. And I showed my mother, I just had to, and she was so happy, you know. But Sylvia's done a little bit of that work, and I think it is an important thing to study, but I think it has to be studied in the context of broader questions. We have to stop. Okay, thank you very much.